This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
It's such a pleasure to host Andrew Solomon this evening. And I just have to say, on a personal note, it's a double bonus also to have with us one of Politics and Prose's absolutely most favorite Washington writers and literary activists, Azar Nafisi. And I will say more about Azar in a moment, but I've been racking my head to figure out how to attempt to do justice to Andrew Solomon's life and career in a brief introduction. And I decided that it's sort of like trying to rewrite War and Peace as haiku. But I will do my best. I think many of you already know that he's a superb prize-winning author and journalist and activist. He's also a professor of psychology. And in these various modes of his career, he has traversed a lot of territory, covered many landscapes, from the workings of the human mind to explorations of identity to the psychology of families, and in his new book, The Importance of Place in Our Individual and Collective Lives. I hope that many of you have read his most recent book called Far From the Tree, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award. I'm sure you followed his pieces in The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. Maybe you've heard him on NPR. Or maybe there are several hundred of you here and you are among the 12 million people who have viewed his wildly popular TED Talks. His new book is his fifth. It's called Far and Away, Reporting from the Brink of Change, Seven Continents, 25 Years. It's a collection of essays he wrote over a quarter century, as you might have guessed from the title, based on his travels to Russia, Ghana, Brazil, and other countries. And I think, again, to try to kind of sum up this masterful and fascinating book, I realize that like his earlier works, you really can't categorize it as a particular genre other than a genre of its own. It's just simply not traditional travel writing. It's not, you know, dispatches from war zones. And I think that is what makes Andrew such an exceptional and special writer and chronicler and observer of the human condition. While he explores the nuances of being in foreign countries and culture, he also focuses on people, on their humanity, their creative expression, their notions of belonging and fitting in, and their connection to cities and countries and cultures undergoing change and upheaval. Now, when you know that much about this book, I have to say, who better, really, who better anywhere in the world to be in conversation with him about this than Azar Nafisi? Azar knows a thing or two about people living under tyranny and repression and cultural hegemony and other forms of emotional and political and cultural exile. She is, of course, the author of the great international bestseller, Reading Lolita in Tehran. It's a memoir, I'm sure most of you have read it, based on her clandestine teaching of literature during the Islamic Revolution in her native Iran. The book won more prizes than I can possibly cite here. It remains a great influence on readers around the world today. And I want to also note she's written many books, but I want to note her most recent book from a few years ago called The Republic of Imagination. If you don't know it, you must read it. It also celebrates the power of literature to guard against tyranny and sustain the human yearning for freedom. Now, like with Andrew, it would take me all night to try to catalog the enormous achievements of Azar's life and career, from her social commentary in leading publications to her books, her courageous, outspoken, and always eloquent defense of human rights and women's rights. So I'm just going to leave you with this. Suffice it to say that our two guests tonight are not only influential writers and thinkers, but they are deeply inspiring to people everywhere seeking to understand our world better and to do good in it. And so I hope you will join me in welcoming them. And before they come up, though, we will be watching a brief video, but please join me in a round of applause for Azar Nafisi and Andrew Solomon.
I want people to come away from this book with a sense have visited 87 countries and written about many of them. I started off wanting to get over my fear of the world. I was kind of a frightened kid, and in some ways this book tells the story of how I gradually let go of all of that fear and took on board the idea that it was possible to go anywhere, to meet anyone, to look at almost anything. I started off writing about artists in Moscow and Leningrad at the end of the Soviet Union. I drove a reindeer in Mongolia. I went dog sledding with the Inuit in Greenland. I attempted to get to Antarctica on a dysfunctional icebreaker. When I was in Senegal, I actually was the subject of an undog, or a tribal exorcism of the Senegalese ritual for the treatment of mental illness. At the sort of key high point, I was pulled out of the makeshift wedding bed I was sharing with a ram in the center of the town square, yanked to my feet, my clothes were pulled off, and I was covered in the blood of the ram who had just been slaughtered. And I thought, this is a far cry from psychotherapy as it's practiced in New York. Extraordinary joy. I reported from Libya. Life under Gaddafi was much worse than anyone who wasn't there can say. There was enormous hope that when he fell, there would be something brave and just coming his way. And what has ensued instead is a terrifying chaos. I look at the ways in which those hopes were frustrated, and I find nonetheless that the people I got to know remember that moment of hope and that it was transformative. It is something for them to hold on to. And often, I think, hope occurs repeatedly and change occurs after hope's multiple inceptions. It takes a great many failed moments of hope before the moment when that hope is actually realized. While I was working on this book, we entered the global world in which what happens everywhere affects what happens everywhere else. If your life is going to be changed by what happens in Moscow or Beijing or Lusaka, you need to know about and understand those places. So much of the time now, people seem to feel that they're caught in the crosswinds coming from places they don't know or understand. I hope this book will help them to know and understand those places better. Someone's going to come and blow up the place where we live and the place that we love. The basis of our having any feeling of security is interacting with the world. Over the course of the last few decades, I've gone to an awful lot of places. The reality often is that what people would most like is to understand you and to be understood by you. That humanity is full of a yearning for mutual seeing. I would like this book to open the hearts and minds of readers to a larger world and make them see that what they perceive to be threatening is actually in many instances joyful.
Andrew would be to talk about the book. And so what I thought I would like to do, in fact, was to just say a few words about my response to the book in order to open it to the first two questions that I have to ask you. Because as I was sort of progressing into reading this book, I thought, oh my God, you know, this book is, in fact, about two very important components of human psyche in terms of surviving and connecting as human beings. And the first thing, when you talk about travel, and travel both in your mind and heart and spirit as well as physically, you're talking about that sort of insatiable urge to know, that essential urge to know. You're talking about curiosity. And you know, Andrew, I felt, had connections to many authors, but more than anything else to this fictional character called Alice. I felt that, you know, only a character like Alice would see not just a white rabbit, but a white rabbit that runs. And not just a white rabbit that runs and talks and has a, you know, wears a waistcoat, but she dares run after that rabbit and jump down that wall, risk jumping down that wall without thinking what will happen to you. Alice might have been more polite to you because as she was going down the hall, she was putting the jars on the shelves, but you might be just as polite. And the second thing that I felt was so important about this book was that very recently misused word, empathy. The fact is that once you become curious, once you go out of yourself, then you genuinely connect with people. And through the alternative eyes of others, you discover not just who they are, but also that intimate stranger within you. And it is through this empathy and this curiosity that I feel this book has been written. So you celebrate difference while at the same time you have the shock of recognition, because more than differing from others, you're surprised by how much you share in common. So what I wanted them to do through these alternative eyes that you have given to us as a gift, to ask you two questions. And the first one is more personal, and the second one goes a little bit more public. When I was reading the first part of your book, I mean the introduction, there were three conversations. One with your father at the very beginning of the book, one with your daughter, and one with your son. And reading these conversations, I felt, well, this is the frame for where this book is going. And I just wanted to ask you to tell us a little bit more about those three conversations and how this personal life sort of its nuances and glows and glimmers follow us throughout your book. In what way?
Well, first of all, I want to thank all of you for coming. I want to say that in an era in which reading is too often devalued and in which books are too often sold as if they were cosmetics, that Politics and Prose represents everything one dreams of in a bookstore and in intellectual communities. And also to thank Azar Nafisi. I'm so unbelievably honored that you would take the time to read the book and to talk to me.
Just unbelievably.
So let me begin with those three conversations. The first was with my father. I was about 6 or 7 years old, I think, and we were driving back from doing something or other near the place where we spent weekends, and he made an allusion in passing to the Holocaust, and he thought I knew about the Holocaust, and in fact, I didn't. And so as he spoke about it, I said, what are you talking about? What is that? And he began to explain it to me. And the more he explained it, the less I felt I understood it. I thought, how could that have happened? And how could it have happened to all of these people because they were Jewish? And I knew that we were Jewish, and I thought it could have happened to us. And I kept trying to find sense in it. But finally I said to him, but Dad, or Daddy probably then, I said, why didn't those people just leave when things got so bad? And my father said, they had nowhere to go. And I remember thinking, even then, even when I was a little kid, I thought, I'm never going to be in that situation. I'm always going to have some place to go. And I hatched the idea, I'd already been interested in the world, but I thought, I would like to have friends everywhere. I would like to know people in every country, on every continent. I would like to know that if the troops ever close in, if the nuclear war comes, if fascism takes over the city where I live, I will have an infinity of other places to go. And I think that in some ways launched me on the course of investigation that this book represents. Now, the story with my daughter was just rather a sweet story, which was that when I took my children to travel, I took them when they were very little, and lots of people said to me, there's no point taking them at this age, they'll never remember it. And I had two issues with that assertion. The first is that you don't have current experience solely for the sake of future memories, and there was an actual time we spent together in these different places. The second was the sense that actually, even if they weren't going to remember this particular trip or what we had seen, I thought they will grow up with a sense that the world is a large place and full of possibilities, knowing that other people speak differently and live differently and act differently in those other places, and it will be woven into the fiber of their being. And I remember being on a trip when I had taken my children to Paris, and my daughter was just 2.5, and it was sunset, and I took her out to look at sunset over the Place de la Concorde, which I remembered my own mother having done with me once upon a time. I was very lucky to be able to travel when I was little. And she suddenly threw her arms around my neck and said, "Oh, Daddy, I'm so happy." And a little while later, we were playing at home, probably a year later, and she said, "My doll needs to get something good to eat." And I said, "Oh," I said, "are we going to take your doll to Central Market, which is the market nearby?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Where are we going to take your doll then?" And she said, "Paris." I thought I may have unleashed a frightening can of worms here. And the conversation with my son, which was much more recent, he's now 7, when he was still 6, I said to him one day, "George," I said, "if you could go anywhere in the world, anywhere in the world," I said, "where would you most like to go?" And he thought for a minute, and then he said, "Syria." And I said, "Syria? George, why Syria?" And he said, using a phrase that I'm afraid is a not infrequent one in our household, he said, "someone has to tell those people about unacceptable behavior."
Washington. I think someone should please. Their behavior is rather atrocious, as you know. I hope you have watched your CNN before coming here. Ted Cruz, Carly Fiorina, Donald Trump reading from whatever he was reading from. So which brings me to my more public sort of question, because I love the way you play with these different levels, so that personal and public and political and cultural are very separate and independent and yet interdependent and each define the other. And so you're in this city, which I believe in many ways is one of the most dangerous cities in the world. And because there are other dangers apart from bombs and, you know. And a lot of people in this city would say, at this time of crisis, why should we learn about the loneliness in Greenland, or go to Antarctica in that very dangerous manner? Or that ram, he stole the ram, because I was going to ask him, and I want to read you the title of that chapter. "Naked, covered in ram's blood, drinking a Coke, and feeling pretty good." So how would all these adventures relate to this town, this place, this country, these times? In what way are they relevant?
Well, I'm always hesitant to get into highly explicit politics at this exact moment, but perhaps I'll go ahead and do it. I think there is a real sense that politicians are trying to capitalize on fear. And they're trying to capitalize on fear by escalating the level of everyone's fear and anxiety. And in doing so, to close us off from the rest of the world. And I think what they're doing is based on a profound misapprehension about and safety and people's perceptions of safety. They've set up the idea that if you build enough walls and block out enough immigrants and monitor enough Muslims and do enough of the rest of this stuff, that you, by doing that, can put yourself into a safe fortress and citadel. In the first place, I think it's an unfortunate tendency because you put yourself not in a beautiful fortress, but in a dank prison. But more profoundly than that, I think it's very naive about the way that human beings relate to one another around the world. When I was working in Libya, I spent a lot of time with members of the Libyan government, and I found that the ones who were in favor of rapprochement with the West were almost without exception those who had gotten graduate degrees in the US, the UK, or Western Europe. And I found that the people who wanted to see an escalation of hostilities and continued isolationism were the ones who had spent very little time out of their own country. So while I recognize that it is the case that visas were given to the hijackers who on 9/11 caused the terrible tragic events of that day, I think the idea of therefore closing down our receptivity to all of the people who live in those other societies is actually not only ugly, but also really very dangerous, and that the people who are most violently promising safety in the current electoral campaign are the ones who will ultimately make us the least safe of all.
And you mentioned a conversation in relation to what you say. You mentioned a conversation with McNamara about Vietnam, and I think that that conversation further proved what you were just saying.
So I got to know Robert McNamara toward the end of his life, and he was very regretful of the role he had played in leading the effort of the Vietnam War. And he wrote a book and talked to me about the book, and I also read the book, which was about his return to Vietnam, where he met some of his counterparts, where they were all old men. And the conversation that took place over and over again seemed to be the Vietnamese saying, "But why did you do so-and-so on such-and-such an occasion?" And he said, "Because you had done such and such and you were escalating things." And they said, "No, we were trying to calm things down. But when you did that, we thought you were trying to escalate things." And he said, "No, I was trying," you know, it went back and forth. And if it hadn't been for the fact that these untold numbers of lives had been lost in the war, it would have been actually quite a comical conversation. It was like a French farce. "You're kidding, you meant that? I didn't mean that, I meant this," sort of conversation. And I said to him, how do you make sense of having played a role in all of that? And he said, "I argued with those other people in the language of war, which I believed to be a universal language, but it isn't a universal language." And as we find ourselves entangled in what I think we are now calling conflicts rather than wars in various places around the globe, I think it's important to recognize how often it is likely that we are misreading the actions on the other side, and that it is necessary for us to be engaged in a constant battle toward translation, not translation only of words, but translation of paradigms so that we can make sense of what is happening. And I think the grossest misapprehension that's in circulation is the idea that somehow democracy, more or less as it exists here or has existed here, is the natural default state of people, and if you take away the impediments, it will rise to the surface. My experience is that democracy is not the automatic default, and that if you take everything that is wrong away, what you're left with is chaos. That democracy as we've defined it, and the question of whether it's suitable to be exported, is another large and complicated question. But even if it is, if it's to be exported, it has to be supported, it has to be tended, it has to be grown, it has to be created. It can't simply be presumed.
Yes, as you were talking, I kept thinking that one of the most dangerous things that is happening in our country today is this sort of deliberate act of ignorance. I mean, it's sort of a reign of ignorance when we know so little about our own history, our own culture, what this country was founded upon, and we know nothing about others. And one thing, which doesn't sound related to politics, but it is what you wrote, this marvelous thing you wrote, not in this book, you're in the habit of writing marvelous things, apparently, in your writing on Blake, Job's testament, the passage on Job and the fact that for Blake, Job was suffering because he was trying to evade suffering. That life of God and okay.
I have to interrupt here with the unfortunate news that while I have read and enjoyed that book, there is someone else named Andrew Solomon who is an academic who's written a great length on Blake.
No.
Well, I love Blake, and I'm deeply committed.
That went so well with what you had said, because of the fact that when I was reading your book, there was constant talk about how, I didn't want to get ahead of myself, what constant talk about how, like in Myanmar or in other places, people welcomed their suffering. People welcomed their suffering and they learned from their suffering. While what I see in America is an evasion of suffering. And I was talking about this to a friend, and she sent me an article. She said, this Andrew Solomon you're talking about has written this book. And I thought, I'm going to write her back.
I'm sure I should have just
She said that this goes very well with what you're talking, with what we were talking about that night. You know, and but now I was going to go with something else, but maybe we should stay with this.
Well, I was going to say only in the first place that I occasionally, because this has come up before, have thought that I should just pretend I did write the book, but I have a fear that the other Andrew Solomon is out there and is about to interrupt me.
You did write Noonday Demon, right?
I do.
Just think this. But you only said one article and one New York Times review of your adults. But anyway, sorry, but it was rather strange. And that Andrew Solomon... Okay, what... I will wait and come to Myanmar, because one of the most interesting things I found in this book was how good and evil, pain and pleasure, life and death are in constant interaction with one another. And one thing that worries me about America today is evasion of pain. From the reality shows to the way we judge politics, dividing everything into good and bad, and our desire to escape tragedy, you know. And what you express, especially in Myanmar, but almost in Afghanistan, I'll come to, in all these countries, is how they embrace the pain in order to resist it. And I thought that it is very good for America today to know about this, because once America was doing the same thing.
Now, there is actually the point of continuity in my work. People have said to me, but you are writing about these psychological issues, and now suddenly you're writing a book about travel, and how do they connect? And I feel like how they connect is that I think all of my work, from the beginning to the end, is in one way or another about how people take circumstances of grave misfortune and build them into occasions of remarkable dignity. Not only of dignity, but also frequently of intimacy, of engagement, of seeing. So on the psychological front, I've often quoted Ovid, who said, "Welcome this pain, for you will learn from it," which sounds like a very admirable idea. I've also talked about Lucretius and his idea that the sublime is the exchange of easier for more difficult pleasures, a notion within which is buried the idea that difficult pleasures are actually often deeper and more profound than easier pleasures and are therefore worth the difficulty. Sometimes they're more profound because of the difficulty, because it motivates you to look at them so closely. The first international reporting I did was about a group of Soviet artists and how their lives changed during Glasnost. That was the topic of my first, now rather obscure, book. And when I went off to meet those artists, what was most striking to me was that out of their circumstances of relative abjection, they had extracted so much joy and so much humor, so much a sense of freedom within the context of that oppression. And I think often, for example, of one of the artists I knew who had been sent to punitive military service in Kamchatka, at the eastern end of Siberia, just above Japan. And he was in a battalion that was mostly murderers and thieves and so on. It was punitive service, which was used when they didn't want to call so much attention to someone's punishment as they did with the sentence to the gulag. And Kostya was there, and there are many amazing stories of his time there, but at the halfway through or so, they discovered how good he was at painting and drawing, and they had to make propaganda art. In his first exhibition in the West, which took place in Graz in Austria, he had a little plaque that he put on the door, and it said, "In 1981, I was sent east, farther east than I had ever dreamed of going or wanted to go. And when I was there, I was put in a room and given the supplies necessary to make art. And I decided to do it, even though I did not agree with the ideology it related to, because it kept me from hard physical labor. Now, I am in the West, farther west than I ever dreamed of going or wanted to go. And once more, I have been put in a room. And once more, I have been given art supplies. And once more, I suspect that they relate to an ideology I do not entirely agree with. But once more, I am happy to do it if it will keep me from hard physical labor." So, with that liveliness, and in Myanmar, which you asked about specifically, I mean, the people I met in Myanmar, where I was just 2 years ago, were many of them people who had worked toward the sort of shift that has now taken place. And it was very thrilling to be there at a time when that shift was taking place, even though there are all kinds of problems with the way it's taken place and with freedoms that remain curtailed. There were two women I met who were both unbelievably strong. One was a woman named Dr. Mathida, who had written things that she knew would cause her to be sent to prison, had been sent off to prison, and when she was there, had focused on meditating and on trying to awaken an inner life, because there was nothing in the outer life that she was leaving. And she said to me that she felt she had succeeded in that. She went through many terrible things during the time she was there, but she said that in the end, her jailer had come to her and said, "Mathida, you are free, and we are not." She talked about how when she left, she said, "I thanked him for the time we had in prison. I did not thank him for setting me free. I had reached the point at which I could thank him for what had happened to me." And then another writer, not related, named Matanagi, who writes in English quite wonderfully. But she said to me that she had taken a job as Aung San Suu Kyi's personal assistant. She had taken the job knowing, again, perfectly well that she would go to jail. And I said, "What was it like for you in jail?" And she said, "I had the most wonderful time." And I said, "You had a wonderful time in a Burmese prison?" And she said, "The objective of the people who put us in prison was to make us miserable. And we quickly realized that if we could manage to be happy in prison, we had completely defeated their purposes." She said, "So I was in a prison with some other women, but they remained close friends. We have lunch together on a regular basis. We decided to have a good time. And I had a sense that that pleasure was both a means of self-preservation and a deliberate and political act. But it was nonetheless really authentic." She had wonderful stories to tell about those years.
Yeah, and there was a quote about, one of them said, "The best way to oppose the regime was to be happy."
Yes.
In prison. And it reminded me of Iran, because people don't understand that this is not a political fight, it's an existential fight.
Yes.
You know, they want to eliminate you as a unit, as an individual. And the more you are you, as Havel would say, the more defeated they feel. And that is how the young women, especially in Iran, defeated the regime. And when I was reading this, I thought, that is what we all share. I always thank the Islamic Republic for making me love the wind in my hair. Mm. You know, my skin touched by the sun, you know. All of these things that we take for granted, the Islamic Republic made me really, really love. While we are talking about this, you have been to so many countries, like we talked about Myanmar, Russia, then in the book you're talking about China, South Africa, Libya, all these countries that are in moments of transition. And there is a moment of absolute joy, as it was in Iran, and then darkness. in each of these. And this is a serious problem, you know, for us and the world.
The piece that I think often gets lost, and I'd be interested in whether you think it's true about Iran as well, is that even when the hope has been frustrated, that doesn't mean that the hope had no meaning. No. So one of the Russian artists who I was very close to said to me, when just before I turned the final draft of the book in, just in time to squeeze, shoehorn his remark into the introduction, we were talking about Putin's Russia. We were talking about the sense that all of the liberties that had been contemplated had really essentially been revoked, or at least most of them had. And I said to him, you know, do you think it would have been easier if you hadn't had such high expectations? And he spoke of those expectations the way that I've heard some people speak of a happy childhood, as having given him a certain resilience. And he said, even if nothing we believed in came to pass, and even if none of it worked out in the ways that we wanted it to work out, having had that moment of hope, having had that moment of hope was utterly and profoundly transformative for us, and we are permanently changed by it. He said, and I would not give up that experience of hope. It is my happiest memory. I hold on to it. And I experience everything that's gone wrong since in a different way than I would have without that. Now, others have said to me, having had that moment of hope only made the contrast of the descent into darkness worse. People have said, the Soviet system felt like it had happened to us. This feels like something we have done to ourselves. So there is another angle on that as well. But I decided it was worth chronicling what those moments of hope felt like, and particularly how they bit by bit begin to add up, and how in my experience, and of course I couldn't plan it this way because I didn't know what was going to happen as I went to places, there are places like South Africa, like Myanmar, where things actually are better. They're not perfect, but they're definitely better. And there are places like Libya, as I said in the film, and to some extent even like Russia, where things are really not much better. In some instances, they're worse. You can't tell when you're in the moment of hope whether it's going to work or whether it isn't going to work. And if you lose the optimism to keep pursuing that moment of hope, then none of them will work.
It's wonderful. And I'm coming to Afghanistan. I'm going to use Afghanistan. I mean, we could sort of divert ourselves to the other areas because I think that it says a lot. It's an example of a lot of things that you talk about in other countries. And for me, it was important because when I came to this country, one of the things that helped me most was that I felt that in a country like Iran, they confiscate your history, they confiscate your culture, they confiscate everything that you are and redefine you. And when I came here, I realized that it is always the victors who, even in a country like this, define who you are. You know, and so they had reduced all these countries with fantastic names like Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Malaysia, Indonesia, and reduced it to one, which was religion. And that religion that has so many different dimensions, including the Sufis you talk about, the most peaceful people in the world, they had reduced it into one aspect of it. And so they would look at me, they would look at Roya or Taraneh in the audience, and they would say, oh, but you're Western. As if Afghani people did not have those Buddhas that were destroyed. These countries are ancient, and the first thing they do is eliminate history. That is why what you were saying about Afghanistan especially really, you know, a special place for me. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about it because it is so easy to adopt the easy way and to choose the language of the oppressor and go into the domain of the oppressor and dance with your jailer than to keep your mind separate. And you do that very well, and the people you talk to do that quite well.
Well, there are several pieces to that. In the first place, I think we are often complicit in that process of giving countries over to their leadership and government and thinking of them in those terms. The destruction of the Bamiyan Buddhas in Afghanistan was an act of aggression against Afghan history. It was not just an act of aggression against a particular group of people. It was an attempt to erase a past, not only a pre-Islamic past, but in many instances an attempt to erase a pre-Taliban past. It was a very particular agenda from the Taliban. Now, when I was in Afghanistan, I went to the National Museum there. The director of the National Museum of Afghanistan, at the time the Taliban came to power, got in touch with people at UNESCO and said, the Taliban will ultimately destroy these great monuments, especially the Buddhist monuments that we have in the museum. He said, but they won't care if we take things out now. And he said, I found a museum in Switzerland that will house this material until the Taliban has left, and then we'll return it to Afghanistan. And the people at UNESCO said, it is against our policy to remove cultural patrimony from its country of origin. And he said, yes, but it's remarkable work that is going to be destroyed if it's left here. And they said, it is against our policy to remove cultural patrimony from its country of origin. And when I went to the National Museum in February of 2002, toward the end of the invasion, or toward the end of that phase of the invasion, he had set up in the National Museum trays that were full of rubble. And over each one, there was a little photograph of what the work had been, the Great Kanishka, possibly the most important piece of Central Asian Buddhist art that had ever been made. And there, it was sand that was left behind, each tray with a picture above it. So I feel like we all get drawn into this process of doing that. As for lumping everyone together, I think one of the problems in a lot of this reporting is that people go in and they tend to interview at two levels of a society. They interview government leaders or maybe people who are big in business, who are the powerful people in a society, most of whom know what they want to communicate and give rather canned and directive responses to questions. And then there is the voice of the common man, which comes up in the encounter with the waiter in a restaurant, or with the person who cleaned their room, or with a taxi driver, or their barber, and they tell you what that person had to say. Now, government officials say things that are important to know, and the so-called common man, if there is any such thing, can sometimes be very insightful, but most societies have a large body of people in them who are intelligent, who are educated, who are trying to reckon with what's going on in their society, and who are not in its official structures in ways that constrain their ability to speak, even if they have concerns about speaking to foreign journalists under certain circumstances. And that large swath of people who are, I will dare to say, the equivalent of at least many of the people who are gathered in this room tonight, those people are often neglected in reportage. And so you either are accepting what has been said from on high, or you're challenging it in ways that are not very well fleshed out. And the complexity of the societies tends to get erased.
It's wonderful. In the interest of time, I'm going to ask two questions. So that one thing you say, I cannot find it, but I remember you talked about you always had maybe your doubts about how useful or beneficial art is, or how responsible it is for society. And to your relief, you discovered that that was true. And you bring marvelous examples from almost all these places. I love that woman in South Africa, Masamba, the one dreams who became ill. Oh, you have to steal the book and read it.
You can also buy it.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean. I don't know why I said that, but okay, buy it. Definitely buy it from comics and prose, actually. Not Amazon, please. Please, this is not the kind of book you can buy. That. Now with Afghanistan, you have this guy. You talk about their love of music, and you talk about this guy Abdul Rashid Moshini, who tells him, you should tell.
Now you say which thing with you?
Because the Taliban had told him that if he plays his instrument, they're going to cut his finger.
Abdul the Sarandar, yes, exactly. So, there was a whole world of musicians. Under the Taliban, music had been illegal in Afghanistan. Someone told me about a woman who had been executed for singing to her baby. even religious music was illegal. In fact, almost all of what we would consider artistic self-expression was illegal. And people had taken these extraordinary risks in order to retain a connection to their instruments. And there was one man who described to me how he had realized he would go crazy without music because he loved it so deeply. And then he explained that he had been talking to a friend and saying that he was ready to die from this deprivation. And his friend said to him, "There's one kind of music they can't make illegal." So he went down to the market and he bought 20 doves. And he had a small house, a room that was much smaller than the stage. And he had 20 doves flying around all over the place. It was a little messy. But he nonetheless that way had music. And then there was someone else who had played the serendal, which is an Afghan instrument. And when the regime came in, all musical instruments were supposed to be destroyed. And he hid his serendal in the woodpile outside his house. And he would move around the wood in the woodpile. And he knew that if a neighbor found it, that he would have it taken away and that he would quite possibly be executed or have his hand cut off. And he said that nonetheless, he managed to keep it there that whole time. Well, when I met him, he was back to playing. He had sort of been working on his morning serendah. And I said to him, did you still remember after 5 years how to play? And he said, but I practiced every night in my dreams.
It is so beautiful. It reminded me of this Persian painter. She's a marvelous painter. And she told me that Iran is so without color now, you know. That what I'm painting is the colors of my dreams, you know, and it is amazing. There's so much about art, maybe you would like, because I also wanted to talk about Romania and all that fiasco around Romania. Would you like to talk about that?
Sure. So I will begin by saying that my father's father was born in Romania, and he came to the United States in 1919, I think it was, fleeing pogroms in that part of the world. And I had wanted to go and see where we came from in Romania, and a couple of my books were being published in Romanian, and I was invited to come and do a book tour. And so I went up to do the book tour, and I went and met various Romanians. And when I was coming over, someone who knew that I was coming had helped to arrange for me to give a talk to Afcept, which is the LGBT group. And I've been very interested in lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender issues in the various places where I've gone. And they had arranged for me to do it in the library of the National University, which is a stunningly beautiful space with a fantastic lecture there. Well, I came over, and then they realized that I was going to be talking about gay topics in the library. And the director of the library stopped returning calls from the organizers, and the event was canceled, and eventually it was moved to a much lesser location on the far outskirts of Bucharest. And I spoke to the people in the far outskirts of Bucharest, and I realized what the level was of sort of oppression and fear that they had lived in, even though homosexual acts are not strictly illegal in Romania. Then I went off to this place in the north of Romania to go and see where my family came from. It was the place when I had said to my great aunt that I wanted to go. I said, "What is the name of the place where we come from?" And she said, "I don't remember." And I said, "Aunt Rose, you were 17 when you left. What do you mean you don't remember?" And she said, "It was a terrible place. We were lucky to get out of there, and there's no reason for anyone to go back." And I said, "Okay, but just tell me what it was called." And she said, "I don't remember." That was the end of that conversation. So I went off. I got back, was coming back from there, and I had put up a posting on my personal Facebook page in which I commented on this unpleasant experience of having my lecture canceled and said, you know, my forefathers fled because there were problems for gay people. I've come back rather triumphantly with two books being published. Nonetheless, I mean, my forefathers left because of problems for Jews, and now I'm encountering this prejudice against gay people. And somehow my Facebook post got picked up, It was picked up by the leading Romanian wire service. It ended up all over the Romanian papers. And the chargé d'affaires, who was the acting ambassador at the time, called me and said that he was going to bring it up as a diplomatic matter, that the idea that a gay author was cancelled out of his venue because he was gay was really shocking. And I was kind of amazed that the whole thing had blown up in this way. And the night that I came back from Dorohoi, which, by the way, rest in peace, Aunt Rose, is where the time they had come from, I was giving a lecture at the New European University, and I had expected to have a crowd of maybe 50 people, which was more or less the number who would have been held there, and it was a conversation with Romania's leading literary figure, much as I have this conversation with Azor, Mircea Charterescu, who is a wonderful writer, and I arrived, and there were 400 people crowded into this relatively small theater, and we started a conversation, and about 10 minutes into it, Mircea said, "I just want to say to you, on behalf of many people in Romania, that we all know what happened with the library at the Central University, and that I want to apologize." And everyone burst into applause. And at the end of my reading, one person after the next came up to me and said, "There are primitive forces in our government, but they don't speak for all Romanians." And I ended up leaving there feeling a kind of embrace of myself and of my identity that I would never have anticipated. And back to your point about the complicated layers of these things that I would not have encountered if it hadn't been for that experience of prejudice.
That is wonderful. And because we don't have time, and I'm going to violate all rules and ask one more question, because I really want to ask this question, I'm sorry. But also, there's so many more. If you want to ask questions, Rwanda, and this chapter, in bed with President of Ghana, you have to read to find out. And the part about Antarctica, and the fact that snow is not white, and the Venice Project, its founder wanted to create an island of dreams for children. So many things, you know, I feel so greedy wanting to talk about it all. But I will end by asking you, actually going to the end of the book, which sort of salutes in a way the beginning, and your amazing and frightening and inspiring experience in Australia, and what it led you to think. And I want to end with this.
I was in Australia now, is that also about 2 years ago, I think? And I wanted always to see the Great Barrier Reef. And so I had gone with my husband and my son. We were traveling together, and an Australian friend had joined us. And we went to a little island resort in the Great Barrier Reef, some place called Orpheus Island. We went off on a scuba expedition. And we got into the water, and I had done a little bit of scuba diving, not a huge amount of scuba diving. I have a license, but I'm not very at ease in the whole process. One of the people who was in our group got into the water and discovered that his tank had not been filled. And I should have thought a hotel that sends people out with an unfilled oxygen tank should be viewed with some skepticism, but I didn't. He got out, my tank was fine, I went down. We scuba dived for a while because I breathed faster than you really should when you're scuba diving, because I'm not totally at ease as a scuba diver. I was running low on oxygen before the others were. And so I showed that to the dive master, and she asked if I was okay to go up. And I said I was okay to go up. And I went up to the surface. And as many of you may know, the protocol is that you get up to the surface and you kind of wave, and the guy comes over in the boat and picks you up, and then you get on the boat and wave. So I came up to the surface, and I waved. And he was vaguely staring in my direction and nodding. And so I began waving more and more ardently, and soon I was doing a wave that was worthy of the Cirque du Soleil. I was kind of jumping out of the water, arms back of the water. And then he sort of walked over to the other side of the boat, and then he walked back and looked in my direction, and he just didn't see me. Well, I won't go through all of the moment by moment, but in the end, I was being carried away by the current from the boat. I thought, he knows what direction the current is going in. This can't be so difficult. I couldn't figure out whether I tried to swim toward the boat. There were big waves coming at me. And then finally I heard that blissful sound. I heard him starting up the motor of the boat. And I thought, now it's all going to be fine. And I watched as he turned the boat in the opposite direction and motored away. And we were so far out that there was no land in sight in any direction. And once the boat had disappeared, I was completely alone and adrift in the middle of everything. And I actually at that point thought, people do die this way. And I had a BCD, a buoyancy control device, which is the sort of vest you wear when you're scuba diving, and I was periodically having to pump it up because the air was going down. And I thought, well, I came to the surface because I was low on air, and I'm going to keep pumping up my BCD, and at some point the air is going to run out. When the air runs out, I'm not going to be able to last very long. And I had this sense of being adrift and afloat in this alien, just everything. And I thought to myself, these may be my last thoughts. I should think something profound. And the thing that came to mind was when Piglet is entirely surrounded by water. And Piglet saying, I wish Pooh were here. So much more cozy with two. Well, as you can tell from my presence on this stage, I was eventually picked up, and I was adrift for about 3 hours. And it was an unbelievably, unbelievably long and frightening time. When we got back, and I'm touched that you've dwelt on my family, who are relatively short appearances here. When we got back to the shore, George had stated that they'd been building sandcastles all morning with my Australian friend. And when we returned and I got back, I was so full of the horror of what had happened. And George, in the mode of he was then four-year-olds, was not interested in asking me what I had done, but wanted to tell me all about where he built the castle, and maybe he got back to the beach, and where there were some other shells, and so on and so forth. And what I said in the sort of closing episode of the book is that I had set out to see the world in part in quest for adventure, having been a frightened child and wanting to have adventure. And I had had a lot of adventure, but I was struck that day when I came back and protecting George from the frightening story of what had happened to me by the way in which the grandest adventure is the one that is involved not only in seeing the world, but also in consenting, at least for a moment, to be the world to your own children. It was a very revelatory moment, and I felt I could write my book now.
Says, I grew up, and I think maybe keep growing up and offering us as gifts his experience of growing up. So please, could you come with your questions to these two microphones?
So for the record, my dad's regular ill, the BC was there, the tank was actually full.
Hi!
We were on the boat together in Australia.
And quite frankly, my friends would probably think it's quite fitting that I'm an aquarium girl. I spent literally an entire weekend with a six-year-old in an aquarium. But I was wondering, what's your favorite place that you have ever been? Because you write about a lot.
Well, I've been to, we haven't met each other since we were in Australia on that boat, on that terrifying day.
You and the girl.
Yeah.
My favorite place, I mean, there's so many ways of being favorite. I would say the two most beautiful places I've been are Mongolia and Namibia and Greenland. I think those were three remarkably beautiful places in very, very different ways, one from the other. I have a deep, soft spot in my heart for Russia. It was the first place I really went in any adventurous kind of fashion. And I ended up with so many friends there. So while it can be bleak and cold and dreary, there's a sort of little romantic piece of me that springs to life when I go back to Russia. And that's beauty and that's intensity. And what are the other qualities one looks for in traveling? I loved my experiences in the Solomon Islands because I have a yen for places that are remote and strange. And when I was in the Solomon Islands, I was there with a high school friend, and her husband and my husband and the four of us had managed to get someone to lead us into the highlands of one of the mountains, where he went to a village where no one had actually seen a foreigner in many, many years. And when we were there, they did a sort of performance for us, played some music and did some dancing and so on, and then they said, "And you have music in your society?" Yes, and they said, "Can you give us some?" So we sang Oklahoma and Jamaica Farewell and some other sort of strangely sort of things. And then they said, "What about dancing?" And I sort of thought, okay. So my high school friend Jessica and I, just knew in fact lives in D.C., but otherwise who isn't going to suddenly surprise me from this audience. My high school friend Jessica and I, they played their pipes, and Jessica and I did swing dancing under a full moon in this village in the middle of the rainforest in the center of the Solomon Islands. And I thought, okay, I thought this is what it is to go and engage and be elsewhere. And it stayed with me forever. Thank you.
What was it like as a writer and as a person to revisit your older work and to work again on this that you first wrote so long ago?
Well, on the one hand, it's kind of disappointing that we grow old, and on the other hand, it's kind of embarrassing that we were young. So there was a lot of it. I mean, I reworked quite a bit of it, not to change the point of view and not to change the content to reflect later wisdom, but just to try to make the voice reasonably consistent. I was struck that I wanted to have a fascinating life and that I ended up having a fascinating life. So the experiences I felt incredibly lucky about and seeing them all kind of pulled together like that was sort of, it was as if there were a great wedding or a great party at which all of the most amazing things came together all in one place. It was thrilling in that regard. I also looked back at it and thought, on the one hand, I'm touched by naive hopes I once had, and on the other hand, I think I used to believe that changing the world was a faster, easier process than it turns out to be. And I guess finally, I thought, to some extent, I had an idealism that was compromised. To some extent, it was the compromising of that idealism that gave birth to a new idealism, which is the idealism that you have to keep fighting even for unrealistic ideals. So I see it more clearly now, but I don't know that I ever quite came to the cynicism that I sort of dipped into for a little bit in that consideration.
Thank you both very much for being here. Andrew, you mentioned, I'm on a first name basis with you, by the way.
Please.
You spoke earlier about your interest in LGBTQ issues and something that the lens through which you observed many of the places that you traveled, and in reference to your experience covered in ram's blood, I wonder if there were other circumstances in which your experience with depression and mental illness was also a perspective that you brought to your travels. And I just imagine how much trauma you witnessed in its aftermath, and how many people you spoke to that lived through trauma, and how many people didn't develop mental illness that managed to somehow avoid it and be resilient. And I wonder if you could speak to what is resilience made of?
There's a simple, straightforward question. I would begin by saying that some of the work I did was specifically about mental illness. I looked at depression among the Greenlandic Inuit. I looked at depression among survivors of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. I interviewed women who had been raped in the genocide in Rwanda about their experiences and the way they've gone forward. Mental illness occurs when there is an intersection between a genetic vulnerability and triggering circumstances. Many of the people I was interviewing had gone through triggering circumstances, and many of the people who had gone through those triggering circumstances had, you know, the same levels of vulnerability that we would have. There, therefore, was a very high rate of suffering and a significant rate of real mental illnesses and disturbances among the people I talked to. And it was an area that I felt in some ways bonded us together. Azar was very generous before in talking about the response to cherish this pain for you will learn from it. I don't want to compare my experience having severe depression, which was the subject of a previous book, with the experience of women who had been raped in the genocide in Rwanda. They're not comparable in scale or kind. But the fact that I had gone through difficulty, I think, made it a little bit easier for me to understand other people's difficulty. And I felt in looking at my own depression, and it's been true of many of the people I met, that there are two approaches to a trauma that you've been through. One of them is to say, I'm not going to think about it, I've gotten through it, and I'm just going to march forward without looking at it. And ironically, it's the people who make that decision who are most likely to be ambushed by the pain of what they have suppressed. And then there's the possibility of saying, I would never have chosen this. The experience was horrible, and yet there was something I drew from it and learned from it. And those people incorporate the horror into a continuous narrative of their own lives. And I think that the mechanism of resilience is frequently that continuous narrative. It's the ability to integrate the terrible things that have happened rather than to flee from them. I don't mean to suggest that in doing that, the difficult things become anything other than difficult, or that there is a real and profound liberation from the horror. The horror is always there. But I think in knowing the things, in thinking about them, and sometimes I hope in talking about them with an intrusive American journalist, that people include them in their sense of who they are and are therefore less frightened by them and by their shadows than they would be if they were constantly trying to avoid their own stories.
I think in the video earlier you mentioned, talked about being sort of an afraid child, sort of a little timid. I just wanted to know how you overcame that to explore the world and embrace it the way that you had.
I was a frightened child, and I remember actually having lunch with my mom when I was maybe 12, I think, yeah. And she said to me, you know, you miss a lot in life by not being more adventurous. And I said, but Mom, I said, I just ordered eel for lunch, which was kind of exotic at that point. And she said, being an adventurous eater is not the same as being an adventurous person. And I decided that I wanted not to be cut off by those feelings of being afraid. I also think in a lot of ways that my kind of early, I mean, again, I wouldn't want to use the word trauma, but my early challenge had been that I was gay, and it took me a while to be ready to come out with that and to say that I was. And when I finally did it, I had such a sense of liberation in having confronted something that so frightened me, and I felt like there was such a sense of retrieving a lost dignity in finally being open about who I was, even though it took time. And I thought, I don't want to be afraid of a lot of other things and to be closed down by them. But I have kind of counterphobic tendencies that I've developed. I mean, I'm afraid of heights, so I went skydiving. You know, it's sort of, it's been my way. And it's not because I stopped being afraid, it's because I was so afraid that I thought if I don't do it, then nothing's going to work. And really, it was going on that first trip to Russia when I went to report on Sotheby's sale of contemporary Soviet art. And I have always traveled as a tourist, which is to say I went and I saw places, I thought they were very beautiful or interesting, and I made comparisons with my own life and happily returned home. And then I got to Moscow. I was stood up by my translator the first day that I was supposed to be interviewing artists. I spent a whole day watching them interact in their studios without being able to understand a word anyone was saying. I saw the nature of the intimacy that they had. I realized that most of the Westerners writing about them hadn't had that particular access that I had had only by happenstance. And I felt as though it actually mattered to address this. It mattered for them, it mattered for me. I'm not going to suggest that my writing about contemporary artists had much of an effect on foreign policy, but I felt amplifying those voices, I got a sense of mission about it. And it stuck with me ever since.
Thank you.
I don't have a question. I just want to thank you because I was introduced to your book in my course I had to take at Mary Washington. And I bought your book and I downloaded the audiobook. And I felt so attached to listening to your words. It's Far From the Tree. It's not the current one we're talking about, but it's. I just felt connected to the book and your book helped me decide what part of psychology I wanted to work in. And I wanted to work with children that have autism spectrum disorder. And I did an internship 3 months ago at the New England Center for Children, and I wanted to see firsthand. I wanted to be in the trenches and see what teachers and what goes on with the programs and everything that goes on with children that have autism. And I saw everything. It was just amazing. I like one part of your book in the chapter of autism where there's this teacher who had her employees or interns go into this dark room and put loud noise and bang things and just make them go crazy and say, what's going on here? And I saw that in my students that I work with in my internship. I didn't feel sad. I didn't feel sorry for them. I was happy because they were succeeding. They were answering questions correctly. They just filled my heart so much, and I want to thank you. And I'm nervous right now speaking to you because you're my distant role model. I love you. You are my fan. You are everything that I can't believe I'm here. And I'm really thankful I'm here because this is my pre-graduation from my boyfriend. And I'm graduating this May 7th in my bachelor's. I'm getting my bachelor's, and I plan to get my master's in ABA. And I want to thank you. Thank you so much for directing me from afar. You are an inspiration, and I love you so much.
Thank you.
Anyone want to say anything after that? It is great to end with love. Oh, I'm sorry. Please. We still have time, right?
I actually worked at Politics and Prose in the Children's Department, but I also recently got a master's in art therapy, and so I haven't had a chance to read far and away yet, but the discussion of art and the importance of it to survival and resilience is something that really interests me, and I was wondering if you could speak a little more to the importance of art and to the idea, you know, so many people think it's a frivolous concern, but to what seems to me to be the universal idea that art is of primal importance and does affect our survival.
I'll conclude maybe with an anecdote by way of answer to that, which is actually one of the first stories in the book. When I got to know the aforementioned Soviet artists, there was a sense that they were all training to keep truth alive in a society that they felt was annihilating truth itself. And they felt they were doing it so that when that society changed, the truth would have been preserved and they could shout it from the rooftops. One of them, when we talked about that, said to me, we were in training to be not artists, but angels. He said, and now suddenly we're thrown into a world of Western commerce where no one is very interested in angels and we are asked only to be artists. And they talked about the difficulty of that transition. I think, in fact, if you look deeply enough, that in every society, our own included, there is a mix of the art which is about producing a commodity that people find decorative or intellectually interesting, and the process of engaging in the moral redemption that adheres in self-expression. And on the third day of the putsch in 1991, I was with those artists when we went up to the barricades at the outskirts of the resistance. It was the coup in which the Soviet Union was failing. And I remember a moment when we faced down the tanks who came, and when the artist said to the soldier on the front tank, they said, this is what democracy is, this is what freedom is, and they delivered a kind of panegyric to freedom of a kind that most of us who live in free societies would never be able to muster. And how the soldier on the front tank then turned around and said, we will leave you your barricade because you have spoken. And I think it was the process of making art over many years that had empowered those artists to be able to explain what freedom was to people who had no regard for it. And I thought, people live or die because this can be understood or can't be understood. and we cannot count on politicians, and we cannot count on others to come up with this language. We have to have artists who come up with the language and then communicate it well enough so that it can be harnessed by people who are in more obvious positions of power. Thank you.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.